This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Recording by Gemma Blythe of Anne of the Island by Lucy Maud Montgomery. Chapter 4. April's Lady. Kingsport is a quaint old town, harking back to early colonial days and wrapped in its ancient atmosphere as some fine old dame in garments fashioned like those of her youth. Here and there it sprouts out into modernity, but at heart it is still unspoiled. It is full of curious relics and hallowed by the romance of many legends of the past. Once it was a mere frontier station on the fringe of the wilderness, and those were the days when Indians kept life from being an ominous to the settlers. Then it grew to be a bone of contention between the British and the French. Being occupied now by the one, now by the other, emerging from each occupation with some fresh scar of battling nation branded on it. It has in its park a Martello Tower, autographed all over by tourists, a dismantled old French fort on the hills beyond the town, and several antiquated cannon in its public squares. It has other historic spots also, which may be hunted out by the curious, and none is more quaint and delightful than old St. John's Cemetery at the very core of the town, with streets of quiet, old-time houses on two sides, and busy, bustling, modern thoroughfares on the others. Every citizen of Kingsport feels a thrill of possessive pride in old St. John's, for, if he be of any pretensions at all, he has an ancestor buried there, with a queer crooked slab at his head, or else sprawling protectively over the grave, on which all the main facts of his history are recorded. For the most part, no great art or skill was lavished on those old tombstones. The larger number are of roughly chiseled brown or gray native stone, and only in a few cases is there any attempt at ornamentation. Some are adorned with skull and crossbones, and this grisly decoration is frequently coupled with a cherub's head. Many are prostrate and in ruins, and to almost all times truth has been yawned, until some inscriptions have been completely effaced, and others can only be deciphered with difficulty. The graveyard is very full and very bowery, for it is surrounded and intersected by rows of elms and willows, beneath whose shade the sleepers must lie very dreamlessly, forever crooned to by the winds and leaves over them, and quite undisturbed by the clamor of the traffic just beyond. And with the first of many rambles in old St. John's the next afternoon, she and Priscilla had gone to Redmond in the forenoon and registered as students, after which there was nothing more to do that day. The girls gladly fresh and stir the pan often. Attach groups of two or three. The peels can set each other. The fresh is wiser midday in generation. And banded themselves together on the big staircase of the entrance hall, where they were shouting at glee with all the vigor of youthful lungs as a species of defiance to their traditional enemies, the sophomores, a few of whom were prowling loftily about, looking properly disdainful of the unlit curves on the stairs. Gilbert and Charlie were nowhere to be seen. Little did I think the day would ever come when I'd be glad of the sight of the Sloanes of Priscilla as they crossed the campus. But I'd welcome Charlie's goggle eyes almost ecstatically. At least they'd be familiarized. Oh, sighed Anne, I can't describe how I felt when I was standing there, waiting my turn to be registered, as insignificant as the teeniest drop in the most enormous bucket. Is that enough to feel insignificant? But it's unbearable to have it grained into your soul that you will never, can never be anything but insignificant. And that is how I did feel, as if I were invisible to the naked eye and some of those sophs might step on me. I knew I would go down to my grave and wept unhonored and unsigned. Wait till next year, comforted Priscilla. Then we'll be able to look as bored and sophisticated as any sophomore of them all. No doubt it is rather dreadful to feel insignificant, but I think it's better than to feel as big and awkward as I did, as if I were sprawled all over Redmond. That's how I felt, I suppose, because I was a good 2 inches taller than anyone else in the crowd. I wasn't afraid a soft might walk over me. I was afraid they'd take me for an elephant or an overgrown sample of a potato-fed islander. I suppose the travelers we can forgive Big Redmond for not being little queen, said Anne, gathering back the shreds of her old cheerful philosophy to cover her nakedness of spirit. When we left Queens, we knew everybody in that place of our own. I suppose we had been unconsciously expecting to take life up at Redmond just where we left off at Queens, and now we feel as if the ground has slipped from under our feet. I'm thankful that neither Mrs. Lynde nor Mrs. Alicia Wright know or ever will know my state of mind at present. They would exult in saying, I told you so, and be convinced it was the beginning of the end, whereas it is just the end of the beginning. Exactly. That sounds more Amish. In a little while, we'll be acclimated and acquainted, and all will be well. And did you notice the girl who stood alone just outside the door of the co-ed's dressing room all the morning? The pretty one with the brown eyes and crooked mouth. Yes, I did. I noticed her particularly because she seemed the only creature there who looked as lonely and friendless as I felt. I had you, but she had no one. I think she felt pretty all by herself, too. Several times I saw her make a motion as too shy, I suppose. I wished she had come. If I hadn't felt so much like the aforesaid elephant, I'd have gone to her. But I couldn't lumber across that big hall with all those boys howling on the stairs. She was the prettiest freshet I saw today, but probably favor is deceitful, and even beauty is vain on your first day at Redmond, concluded Priscilla with a laugh. I'm going across to old St. John's after lunch, said Anne. I don't know that a graveyard is a very good place to go to get cheered up, but it seems the only gettable place where there are trees, and trees I must have. I'll sit on one of those old slabs and shut my eyes and imagine I'm in the Avonlea woods. Anne did not do that, however, for she found enough of interest in old St. John's to keep her eyes wide open. They went in by the entrance gates, past the simple, massive stone arch surmounted by the great pine of England, and on incoming yet the wild bramble is glorying, and those bleak heights henceforth, they'll be famous and sporting. Look at Anne looking at it with a thrill. They found themselves in a dim, cool, green place where winds were fine burning. Up and down the long, grassy aisles they wandered, reading the quaint, voluminous epitaphs, carved in an age that had more leisure than our own. Here lieth the body of Albert Crawford, Esquire. Red Anne from the worn gray slab, for many years, keeper of His Majesty's ordnance at Kingsport. She served in the army till the peace of 1763. And he died from bad health. He was a brave officer, the best of husbands, the best of fathers, the best of friends. He died October 29, 1792, aged 84 years. There's an epitaph for you, Prissy. There's certainly some scope for imagination in it. How full such a life must have been of adventure and as for his personal qualities. I'm sure Union Eulogy couldn't go further. I wonder if A.J. Horton knew us all those best things while he was alive. Here's another, said Priscilla. Listen, to the memory of Alexander Ross, who died on the 22nd of September, 1840, aged 43 years. This is raised as a tribute of affection by one whom he served so faithfully for 27 years, that he was regarded as a friend deserving the fullest confidence and attachment. A very good epitaph, commented Anne thoughtfully. I wouldn't wish a better. We're all servants of some sort, and the fact that we are faithful can be truthfully inscribed on our tombstones, nothing more need be added. Here's a sorrowful little gravestone, Prissy, to the memory of a favorite child. And here's another, erected to the memory of one who is buried elsewhere. I wonder where that unknown grave is. Really, Pris, the graveyard of today will never be as interesting as this. You are right. I shall come here often. I love it already. Redmond this morning. I've been watching her for 5 minutes. She started to come up the avenue exactly half a dozen times, and half a dozen times she has turned and gone back. I think she's dreadfully shy, or she has got something on her conscience that's going to make her. It's easier to get acquainted in a graveyard than at Redmond, I believe. They walk down the long grassy arcade towards the stranger, who is sitting on a grave slab under an enormous willow. She was certainly very pretty, but this isn't a regular bewitching type of prettiness. It was a gloss as of brown nuts on her satin smooth hair and the soft white glow on her round cheeks. Her eyes were big and brown and velvety, and her oddly pointed black brows, and her crooked mouth was rose red. She wore a smart brown suit with two very modish little shoes peeking from beneath it, and her hat of golden straw, wreathed with golden brown poppies, had the indefinable, unmistakable air which pertains to the creation of an artist in millinery. Priscilla had a sudden stinging consciousness that her own hat had been trimmed by her village store milliner, and Anne wondered uncomfortably if the blouse she had made herself and which Mrs. Lynde had fitted looked very contrived and homemade besides the stranger's smart attire. For a moment, both girls felt like turning back, but they had already stopped and turned towards the gray slab. It was too late to retreat, for the brown-eyed girl had evidently concluded that they were coming to speak to her. Instantly she sprang up and came forward with outstretched hands and a gay friendly smile in which there seemed not a shadow of either shyness or burdened conscience. "Oh, I want to know who you two girls are," she exclaimed eagerly. "I've been dying to know. I saw you at Redmond this morning. Say, wasn't it awful there? For a time I wished I had stayed home and got married." Anne and Priscilla both broke into unconstrained laughter at this unexpected conclusion. The brown-eyed girl laughed too. "I really did. I could have, you know. Come, let's all sit down on this gravestone and get acquainted. It won't be hard. I know we're going to adore each other. I knew it as soon as I saw you at Redmond this morning. I wanted so much to go right over and hug you both." "Why didn't you?" asked Priscilla. "Because I simply couldn't make up my mind to do it. I never can make up my mind about anything myself. I'm always afflicted with indecision. Just as soon as I decide to do something, I feel in my bones that another course would be the correct one. It's a dreadful misfortune, but I was born that way, and there is no use in blaming me for it as some people do. So I couldn't make up my mind to go and speak to you, much as I wanted to." "We thought you were too shy," said Anne. "No, no, dear. Shyness isn't among the many failings or virtues of Philippa Gordon. Phil, for short. You call me Phil right off. Now, what are your handles?" "She's Priscilla Grant," said Anne, pointing, "and she's Anne Shirley," said Priscilla, pointing in turn. "And we're from the island," said both together. "I am from Bolingbroke, Nova Scotia. Schulenburg, exclaimed Anne. Why, that is where I was born. Do you really mean it? Why, that makes you a blue nose, after all. No, it doesn't, retorted Anne. Wasn't it Dan O'Connell who said that if a man was born in the stable, it didn't make him a horse? An island of the core. Well, I'm glad you were born in Bolingbroke anyway. It makes us kind of neighbors, doesn't it? And I like that, because when I tell you secrets, it won't be as if I were telling them to a stranger. I have to tell them. I can't keep secrets. It's no use to try. That's my worst failing, that and indecision, as the poor said. Would you believe it? It took me half an hour to decide what hat to wear when I was coming here, to a graveyard. At first I inclined to my brown one with the feather, but as soon as I put it on, I thought this pink one with the floppy frame would be more becoming. When I got it pinned in place, I liked the brown one better. At last I put them close together on the bed, shut my eyes, and jabbed with a hat pin. The thin spirit pink one, so I put it on. It is becoming, isn't it? Tell me, what do you think of my looks? At this naive demand, made in a perfectly serious tone, Priscilla laughed again, but Anne said, impulsively squeezing Philippa's hand, we thought this morning that you were the prettiest girl we saw at Redmond. Philippa's crooked mouth flashed into a bewitching, crooked smile of a very white little teeth. I thought that myself, was her next astounding statement. But I wanted someone else's opinion to bolster mine up. I can't decide even on my own appearance. Just as soon as I've decided that I'm pretty, I begin to feel miserably that I'm not. Besides, I have a horrible old great aunt who is always saying to me with a mournful sigh, you are such a pretty baby. It's strange how children change when they grow up. I adore aunts, but I detest great aunts. Please tell me quite often that I am pretty, if you don't mind. I feel so much more comfortable when I can believe I'm pretty. And I'll be just as obliging to you if you want me to. I can be with a clear conscience. Thanks, laughed Anne. But Priscilla and I are so firmly convinced of our own good looks that we don't need any assurance about them. See, in trouble. Oh, you're laughing at me. I know you think I'm abominably vain, but I'm not. There really isn't one spark of vanity in me. And I'm never a bit grudging about paying compliments to other girls when they deserve them. I'm so glad I know you folks. I came up on Saturday, and I've nearly died of homesickness ever since. It's a horrible feeling, isn't it? In Bolingbroke, I'm an important personage, and in Kingsport, I'm just nobody. There are times when I could feel my soul turning a delicate blue. Where do you hang out? 38 St. John Street. Better and better. Why, I'm just around the corner on Wallace Street. I don't like my boarding house, though. It's bleak and lonesome, and my room looks out on such an unholy backyard. It's the ugliest place in the world. As for cats, well, surely all the Kingsport cats count on Cape Air outdoor cats on mud rides, snoozing for nine spring fires. But cats in backyards at midnight are totally different animals. The first night I was here, I cried all night, and so did the cats. You should have seen my nose in the morning, how I wished I had never left home. I don't know how you managed to make up your mind to come to Redmond at all, if you are really such an undecided person, said a amused Priscilla. Bless your heart, honey, I didn't. It was Father who wanted me to come here. His heart was set on it. Why, I don't know. It seems perfectly ridiculous to think of me studying for a BA degree, doesn't it? Not but what I can do it, all right. I have heaps of brains. Oh, said Priscilla vaguely. Yes, but it's such hard work to use them, and BAs are such learned, dignified, wise, solemn creatures. They must be. No, I didn't want to come to Redmond. I did it just to oblige Father. He is such a duck. Besides, I knew if I stayed at home, I'd have to get married. Mother wanted that. Wanted it decidedly. Mother has plenty of decision, but I really hated the thought of being married for a few years yet. I want to have heaps of fun before I settle down. And ridiculous as the idea of my being a BA is, the idea of my being an old married woman is still more absurd, isn't it? I'm only 18. No, I concluded I would rather come to Redmond than be married. Besides, how could I ever have made up my mind which man to marry? Were there so many? Laughed Anne. Heaps. The boys like me awfully, they really do. But there were only two that mattered. The rest were all too young and too poor. I must marry a rich man, you know. Why must you? Honey, you couldn't imagine me being a poor man's wife, could you? I can't do a single useful thing, and I am very extravagant. Oh no, my husband must have heaps of money, so that married them down to two. But I couldn't decide between two any easier than between 200. I knew perfectly well that whichever one I chose, I'd regret all my life that I hadn't married the other. Didn't you love either of them? Asked Anne, a little hesitatingly. It was not easy for her to speak to a stranger of the great mystery and transformation of life. Goodness, no. I couldn't love anybody. It isn't in me. Besides, I wouldn't want to. Being in love makes you a perfect slave, I think. And it would give a man such power to hurt you. I'd be afraid. No, no. Alec and Alonzo are two dear boys, and I like them both so much that I really don't know which I like the better. That is the trouble. Alec is the best looking, of course, and I simply couldn't marry a man who wasn't handsome. He's good tempered, too, and has lovely curly black hair. He's rather too perfect. I don't believe I'd like a perfect husband, somebody I could never find fault with. Then why not marry Alonzo? Asked Priscilla gravely. Think of marrying a man named Alonzo, said Phil dolefully. I don't believe I could endure it, but he has a classic nose, and it would be a comfort to have a nose in the family, mother was a dawn, and as the burning echoes in the burnest degree, waiting here, adorn nice noses. Your nose is awfully nice, I'm sure. Alonzo's nose nearly turned the balance in his favor. But Alonzo, no, I couldn't decide. If I could have done as I did with the hats, stood them both up together, shut my eyes and shouted with a hat pin, it would have been quite easy. What did Alec and Alonzo feel like when you came away, Queen Priscilla? Oh, they still have hope. I told them they'd have to wait till I could make up my mind. They're quite willing to wait. They both worship me now. Meanwhile, I intend to have a good time. I expect I shall at least suppose it wouldn't. I can't say that feeling if I have, you know. But don't you think freshmen are fearfully lonely? I saw only one really handsome fellow among them. He went away before you came. I heard his chum calling Gilbert. His chum had eyes that stuck out that far. But you're not going yet, girls. Don't go yet. I think we must, said Anne rather coldly. It's getting late, and I've some work to do. But you'll both come and see me, won't you? Asked Philippa, getting up and putting an arm around me. And let me come to see you. I want to be chummy with you. I've taken such a fancy to you both. And I haven't quite disgusted you with my frivolity, have I? Not quite, laughed Anne, responding to Phil's squeeze. With a return of cordiality, because I'm not half so silly as I seem on the surface, you know. You just accept Philippa Gordon as the Lord made her, with all her faults, and I'll believe you'll come to like her. Isn't this graveyard a sweet place? I'd love to be buried here. Here's a grave I didn't see before. This one in the iron railing. Oh God, look, see the stone says it's the grave of the Nitty who was killed in the fight between the Shannon and the Chesapeake. Just fancy. Anne paused by the railing and looked at the worn stone, her pulses thrilling with sudden excitement. The old graveyard, with its overarching trees and long aisles of shadows, faded from her sight. Instead, she saw the Kingsport Harbor of nearly a century gone. Out of the mist came slowly a great frigate, brilliant with the meteor flag of England. Behind her was another, with a still heroic form, wrapped in its own starry flag, lying on the quarterdeck, the gallant Lawrence, Hunsinger had turned back his pages, and that was the Shannon sailing triumphant of the day with the Chesapeake as her prize. Come back, Angela, come back, laughed Philippa, pulling her arm. You're 100 years away from us. Come back. Anne came back with a sigh. Her eyes were shining softly. I've always loved that old story, she said. And although the English won that victory, I think it was because of the brave, defeated commander. I love it. This grave seems to bring it so near and make it so real. This poor little Nitty was only 18. He died of desperate wounds received in gallant action. So reads his epitaph. It is such a soldier I might wish for. Before she turned believe it is, she says herself. But she isn't the officer as she sounds. She's a dear, peaceable baby, and I don't know that she'll ever really grow up. I like her too, said Priscilla, decidedly. She talks as much about boys as Ruby Gillis does. It always enrages or sickens me to hear Ruby, whereas I just wanted to laugh good-naturedly at Phil. Now what is the why of that? There is a difference, said Anne meditatively. I think it's because Ruby is really so conscious of boys. She plays with love and lovemaking. Besides, she'd feel when she is posting a propose, if she is doing it to rub it well into you, that you haven't off so many. Now when Bill talks of propose, it sounds as if she was just speaking of chums. She really looks upon boys as good comrades, and she is pleased when she has dozens of them tagging around, simply because she likes to be popular and to be thought popular. Even Alex and Alonzo, I'll never be able to think of those two names separately after this. Or to her, just two playfellows who wanted to play with them all their lives. I'm glad we met her. And I'm glad we went to Old St. John's. I believe I put forth a tiny soul root into Kingsport soil this afternoon. I hope so. I hate to feel transplanted. End of chapter 4. Libra.